And it's kind of frightening the way he used data. It was an English company that did it for him as well. But the manipulation and the usage of data was so powerful. And even simpler forms of manipulation of data by the NRA, for example.
Welcome to the Marketing Study Lab podcast with me, Peter Sumpton, the Lego master of marketing and marketing consultant, providing you with the building blocks you need to be a successful marketer. This intro lasts about 1 minute, so feel free to skip forward if you've heard all this before. I seriously won't be offended. If you're new to the show, we chat to amazing people to give you practical advice you can implement right now that will make you and your marketing truly awesome. The conversations we have will lead you to the actionable marketing knowledge you've been craving, and now you've found it. So you can relax and enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks to all those that have left a 5-star Apple Podcast review. It's the best way to support what I'm trying to do here. If you have a burning marketing question, you can catch me on LinkedIn. I know I'm supposed to say the links are in the show notes, but let's face it, you've got better things to do than try and find those pesky show notes right now. Enough of the show intro. Let's get on with introducing our guest. This week's episode is slightly different, as we're taking a look back at one of the very first interviews or chats that I did for this podcast. It was episode 10 with PR Paul Smith, the creator of the SOSTAC model. Why am I doing this flashback? Bit lazy? Nah, it's not that at all. Doing it for two fundamental reasons. One, I think it's hugely, hugely important that every single marketer knows and understands the SOSTAC model and how powerful it can be. And secondly, I'm looking to change up the podcast. I'm looking to change it from the conversational style, the hints and tips, the actionable insights that you've been getting for over 150 episodes, into something that looks at the past, present, and future of marketing so you can learn and develop your skills along with the best in the business. Good idea? Bad idea? Insanely stupid? I've got no idea. All I know is that it'll be really fun, really exciting to change up the podcast, so there'll be more on that later. But first, let me introduce PR Smith with the random question from episode 10. What's your favourite acronym?
So it's the simplest one of all is KISS, K-I-S-S, keep it simple, stupid.
Do you try and keep everything simple then?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've kind of adhered to in my helping people to understand stuff, whether it's in books or workshops or one-to-one advice, is if you can demystify it, simplify it, break it down into chunks, digestible chunks, absorb it and then do it. So yeah, keeping it simple works, as with the case of SOSTAC as well.
Excellent, which we'll swiftly move on to in a couple of questions time. But first, what I'd quite like to get to is if you could tell the listeners your story and the magic formula that's brought you to this stage of your career. And by this stage, I mean consultant, trainer, speaker, and obviously renowned marketer.
Oh boy, I don't know if there's any particular magic marketing formula, although I have a magic marketing formula for marketing that I use with clients. In my particular case, I think it might be just empathy, common sense and empathy. And that applies to marketers, really. You know, it's kind of something that's in your bones. You either empathize or you don't. You know, can you empathize with your customer, or in this particular case, with an audience, if it's a book I'm writing for, or if it's a workshop I'm doing, or a client? Can I empathize with them? Can I understand exactly how they see the problem? Can I understand how difficult and how tiring and sometimes how confusing learning can be? So I always try to make my materials, whether it's, you know, as a workshop, a seminar, a talk, or a conference, or writing a book, or articles, or posts, I always try to keep it simple and demystify a topic, break it down into digestible chunks, and then wrap it into some kind of carefully structured answer or solution that's memorable. So that enables the embedding of the knowledge and the ultimate transition into a skill by then applying that and seeing it applied in an example or in their own particular case. And the last thing I'd add to it, to the reasonable success I've enjoyed, is entertainment. or edutainment. I firmly believe, you know, people are tired, they're exhausted, they're under pressure, they've got too much information coming at them, they're drowning in a sea of information, there's pressures left, right, and center. So it's difficult. And one way of making it less painful and more interesting is by making it entertaining, if possible. So I'll always try to add examples that actually make you go, really? Or wow, good enough that will make some, my acid test is it good enough for somebody else to say, have you heard about this? Have a look at this. You know, if it's one of those, it just makes you stop and think. So I try to add that and make it edutainment. So it's education and entertainment mixed together in everything I do.
Love it.
Hopefully that's the key.
It's interesting, an interesting topic really, because one of my favorite sort of, if you want to call it edutainment, the stories that I always go back upon is Guinness and the Guinness Book of World Records. And the reason that it's called the Guinness Book of World Records is because Guinness realized that when people go to pubs, they like to talk about trivia. And what better way to get them to talk about trivia than to sponsor a book about world records?
Absolutely right, yes.
In your title or your many titles, one of them is marketing consultant. Can you just explain what that role is? And as a consultant, what you provide?
Yeah, common sense advice, really, consultancy, and a structure, again, helping people have a simple structure to develop their solutions. So, you know, the kind of people working with, got one amazing client called Mainstream Renewable Power. They're a renewable energy company, and we develop, discuss, and develop their digital platforms, particularly websites, that sort of thing, around the world. We did the same for the previous company, which was Airtricity, wrote the first marketing plan for them. The CEO had to sell it at $1.2 billion. my mistake was, instead of taking a check, I should have said, just give me half a 1% share, we'll do nicely. But the son of Airtricity is this company called Mainstream Renewable Power, and they are a truly incredible company to work with, full of innovation in renewable energy, in the B2B space. Extraordinary company, and a real pleasure working with them. I learn a lot from working with those guys. Another one I'm working on at the moment is Sri Lanka golf. I'm trying to create an inbound golf tourism sector for them. So very upmarket stuff we're looking at for those that want to experience the what they call the pearl in the Indian Ocean. Now, the challenge is they've got a limited number of really good golf courses right now, but it's going to expand. They're doing them up. That'll take a bit of time. So we have to manage expectations, and we're positioning it as sort of golf in Sri Lanka, enjoying the beauty of the island, you know, on the Paradise Island sort of concept. So we're not saying Paradise Golf, we're saying golf on Paradise Island, if you follow me. So that's pure pleasure. I find that kind of consultancy just pure pleasure. The other sort of people work with are SMEs through various government programs. Over the years, lots and lots of SMEs, startups, particularly I like the disruptive startups, which are interesting. I like the energy that people have and the enthusiasm to get on to the playing field that they couldn't have done pre-digital, if you like. It would have been much more difficult. So it's opened up opportunities for all sorts of different clients.
Just on the Sri Lankan golf one, if you need any assistance with user experience or anything like that, in terms of that, I'm open to, I'm available.
Well, what I might do, I might fly you over there first class just yet, but I might put a set of goggles on your head and give you a virtual reality experience of it.
Okay, that's the club. That's close
just
enough.
In your back garden, yeah?
Yeah, I'll turn the heating on when I've got the goggles on so I can feel that warmth, that Sri Lankan warmth. Yeah. Brilliant. On to a more serious topic. You're clearly famed for the Sostak model, which, if listeners don't know what that is, yeah, you shouldn't really be listening to this podcast. How and why did the model appear, and what do you feel is its importance? If you can just take us briefly through how it's actually used as well.
Sure. Well, Sostak was born out of frustration, S-O-S-T-A-C, Sostak. It was born out of frustration because I remember when I graduated, I did a postgrad diploma in finance, then I went on and did a postgrad diploma in marketing, and then eventually did an MBA. And I found myself very frustrated doing an MBA in Cass Business School, which was fantastic here in London. But I was frustrated when I started reading into writing marketing plans, or business plans and marketing plans, that I just felt they were kind of all over the place and unnecessarily complex and almost impossible to remember all the components that you needed to have in there. So what I did was of the cohort that 2 years, because I did mine part time, so I was involved with the full time guys doing their MBAs for 2 years. So I had two years of cohorts that I became friendly with, and I asked many of them to keep in touch and to send me their actual marketing plans, just the content page. Take the client's name out. I just wanted to see their content page. That's all. So I studied those for a couple of years, really. I looked at it, thought about it. I had various attempts of developing an acronym that would help people remember the key components. And in fact, it took me about 10 years to get to finally SOSTAC, S-O-S-T-A-C. So what's important, or why is it important, or why do people like it or use it? It can be, it's flexible. So it can be used for a business plan, a marketing plan, a digital marketing plan, an integrated marketing plan, or even a digital transformation plan. In fact, I did a conference to 350 middle to senior managers in Sri Lanka last year and applied SOSTAC on how they can digitally transform their business. So SOSTAC applies to anything. I mean, I've seen it applied to health and safety plans, security plans, personal life plans, even recently a wedding plan. So, you know, it works. I think people like it because it's simple, easy to remember, but most of all, it has a crystal clear logic to its stages. And that really helps separate strategy from tactics, where things get a bit confused. This helps to separate and make it simpler. So you probably are aware that it was voted in the top three business models by the Chartered Institute of Marketing's Centenary Poll. And that was great because I always knew it was very helpful, but that was kind of an endorsement I didn't expect. And since then, it's been picked up by LinkedIn. Their EMEA offices use it, and their EU offices now use it, which is great. KPMG Digital HQ in Toronto now use SOSTAC. There's PLCs here in London that use SOSTAC. There's hundreds of SMEs around the world that are using it. And even not-for-profits like Greenpeace, for example, now use it here in the UK. So I had a lovely moment actually last week when I got an email from a student, a digital marketing student finalist, who sent me a message to say that she really likes SOSTAC. She used it. It's got her into the finals of the Digital Marketing Student of the Year. And lo and behold, she won it. Lorraine Larkin was the young lady's name from Dundalk Institute of Technology. And she won it. And she wrote me a really nice endorsement saying, you know, that SOSTAC gave her the edge and allowed her to think logically about analyzing stuff. In fact, shall I take it through briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. So you know, S for situation analysis, where are you now? And O for objectives, where are you going? S for strategy, how do you get there? So that's the SOS bit. And T for tactics, which are the details of strategy, which is the marketing mix. A is for action. Now, that's the bit that's forgotten in most plans. And that's the bit about how do you ensure that this wonderful plan will be executed with passion and enthusiasm and excellence itself. So that brings you into internal marketing, you know, communications, training, motivation of your staff. How do you bring them on board? And then C is for control. And that is metrics and measurement. What are you going to measure? Sometimes stuff you look at them once a month, sometimes once a day. Who's going to look at what? Who reports to whom? What do you do when you see a blip? That's the most important piece of it. And what does it cost to measure stuff? How long does it take to collect it and so on? So that's SOSTAC. Add in the three M's, men, money, and minutes. That's men and women, the human resource, money, budgets, and minutes, time. Layer that, integrate that into your plan, and you've got a pretty good structure for a good logical plan. So back to Lorraine Larkin, she said to me that the structure helped her create a crystal clear map for a services company, and lo and behold, she won it. So she was quite delighted with it, and that's opened up the opportunity to go to talk to the people in Dundalk Institute of Technology, into one of their enterprise hubs, and hopefully it'll spread into other enterprise hubs to help other small businesses.
Like you were saying at the very start, with keeping things simple, I mean, it just epitomizes just keeping things simple. And it's strange, because when I started studying for marketing through university and then Chartered Institute of Marketing, it was just sort of the standard that you go to is SOSTAC, and it's just strange to be talking to the person that that actually developed that. It's very weird, but no, really exciting.
Excellent.
So moving on to your many, many books, One thing I'd like to ask, because a lot of those books, if not all of them, feature on future reading lists for the CIM qualifications, regardless of whatever level a student might take. Where would you suggest a student actually starts in terms of reading? Because what I can imagine is it being, or I've been in that position where you get your specific reading list and then further reading list, and it's so overwhelming to think, look at all these books. Where would you start?
Blimey. Well, it depends on the level and the course, the module, I guess. It's a tough one. Yeah, we're becoming less orientated towards reading anyway. Hence your podcasts are a great idea.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah. So I would guess keep it simple again and go with the recommended books, target the recommended one, and then the further readings if you have time. Unfortunately, all the P.R. Smith books, I think a lot of them are on the additional reading, so that probably cuts me out of the cut. But if you want to keep it simple, I'd say go for the recommended one, and if you've time, pick up the others. Although of all the books I've written, the one that I'm very proud of is the Sustac Guide to Your Perfect Digital Marketing Plan. It gets very nice reviews and feedback. It's a short book. You can nearly fit it inside your pocket, and people tell me that they really like it. And I'm doing one edition every year, an update every year now on it. So the 2018 version is just out, and that's the one that I'm particularly proud of.
Excellent. Moving along to more of a passion of yours and mine, really. I noticed that you've developed this great moments of sportsmanship. So what do you think marketers can, well, first of all, if you'd like to tell us what that is, but what can marketers learn from the world of sport as well?
Yeah, yes, that's my personal passion. So my 9-to-5 work is marketing and digital marketing. But then my 5-to-9 work is my personal passion. It's a not-for-profit campaign that I started to save the world, well, inspire the world. Through short stories about sportsmanship, essentially, targeting young people, the new generation of global citizens. So the book itself really is about true 2-minute stories about sportsmanship. So it does look a little strange. If you on my website, prsmith.org, or on Facebook, PR Smith Marketing, you'll see a bunch of books there. And at the end is this sportsmanship book. It's nothing to do with business. It's a personal passion. But I think there are lessons we can learn from the world of sport, and particularly sportsmanship in particular, such as integrity, you know, the value of integrity, you know. And I do believe that nice guys don't come second. I think there's a tendency to think that nice guys get squeezed out of the rat race. And it's not true. There is empirical evidence that nice guys can come first. And I'd like to reassure people about that. And I think the people that work in CSR, corporate social responsibility, get this, and they understand it. But not everybody else understands that in the business. And I guess we are in an environment, always have been, but ever more so now, where brands themselves increasingly need to represent something more than their functional benefits. Now, I know we all know that, but increasingly I feel brands need to stand up for something. And we're starting to see it. The big boys are trying to attach themselves to certain values. And those values actually are at the heart and soul of sportsmanship. So, you know, integrity, friendship, loyalty, honor. These are important in sportsmanship, but they're also important in business. So given that brands essentially are a relationship, you know, that's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. What is a brand? It's a relationship. So how people feel about your brand can be affected by your values and then the way you behave. So in business and in life and in sport, it's important to, I believe, to behave and deliver real values such as integrity, friendship, loyalty, and honor. You know, I produced about 5,000 copies. I didn't even bother looking for a publisher. I just got on with it and did it, and found somebody to make the book, print it, and do all the rest of it, and managed all the logistics, which were painful. But I produced 5,000 copies and pretty much sold them all with minimal effort, just from a few radio interviews and so on, within a year. Now, what I'd like to do now is do a second book, because I have more stories on the blog, greatsportsmanship.org. There's more. I've actually gotten a bigger number of stories sitting there categorized by country and by sport that I can drop into the next book. And what I'd like to do is get 100,000 copies printed this time and then give them away free in inner city areas, inner city schools. Now, I'm pleased to say that I work with the Youth Sport Trust, a pretty innovative bunch of people that kind of control sport in schools, if you like. And they like what we're doing, and they've promised to handle all the logistics for me to get the 100,000 copies, or 200,000 if we can, to city by city around the country and overseas. And my plan is that on the inside of the page of the book, you'd have an announcement saying, if you like this book and if you'd like the Great Sportsmanship Program as a tool for your school to integrate with other classes, you can have the pack, the teaching pack. Just call this number. So that way it might spread. And the plan, my personal plan, is that long after I'm dead and gone, that this will prevail. People are already sending us in stories. We check them out. We publish them on Facebook, Great Sportsmanship Facebook. And the best of those will get written up more fully into the blog, greatsportsmanship.org. And the best of those, then we get those and drop them into the next book. So the books are being written by the people for the people, and with us just managing the middle bit. So while I'm dead and gone, I'm hoping that this will continue. So people that are passionate about it will just carry it forward as a nonprofit. And I think young people really need this stuff. You know, it's a tough time for young people right now. You know, they have it tough. They, you know, there's no jobs for life anymore. The kids are laden with debt when they come out of college, which is appalling. They have fears of terrorism that I never worried about as a child. They have fears of social media bullying, broken families, broken communities, lack of identity, low self-esteem, one in four suffering mental issues. You know, it kind of seems like the system is breaking down a bit. So amidst this crazy world that seems to be even polarizing right now and becoming less tolerant of differences, you know, differences which are great, and we should celebrate differences. And so it's at this particular time that the Great Sportsmanship Program is designed to inspire a new generation of global citizens. And kids and youths and students and adults can become ambassadors of the Great Sportsmanship Program. And it looks good on your LinkedIn page and on your CV. Guaranteed, if you're in a job interview, they will say, what does this mean? You're an ambassador of the Great Sportsmanship Program. What it means is you're an ambassador. Therefore, you share and like the stories amongst when they come out, you track them and share them and like them. That's it. That's all we ask. So it's a nice little thing. And the program for the schools is a 6-week program. There's a TED talk that I've done. If you Google TED plus PR Smith, you should find me, or TED plus PR Smith plus sportsmanship, you will find me. And there's a nice little talk about how sportsmanship can actually save the world during this high tension times we live in. I'm very pleased with it. In fact, I was asked to go to Canada this year and do a corporate talk on sportsmanship as a motivational talk for a team of managers. That was the first time I've ever done that. It wasn't the purpose of it, but it threw some funds in the kitty, which was nice because it costs a few bucks to keep the thing going. And it is a not-for-profit thing. So, yeah, lots of potential. So anybody out there that fancies getting that on the CV or their LinkedIn page, just go to greatsportsmanship.org and do it. And we're on LinkedIn as well, as a group.
Marvellous. We'll put all that in the show notes to make it easy for people to get in touch as well. Just sticking with sport for the moment, have you got a favourite moment of sportsmanship?
Ooh. I mean, we publish one story every day on Facebook. We publish one fresh sportsmanship story every day. So there's buckets and buckets and buckets. I suppose actually my favorite probably is the Iran versus USA. No, actually there was another one that involved Iran in a World Cup match. It was Iran versus Mexico. And the goalkeeper, Sanchez, I think his name was, got a phone call from his mother and said, bad news, your papa's dead. So he asked permission to leave the team, and he flew from Germany, the World Cup was at the time, and he flew back to Guatemala and buried his father. And he's sitting around the table having coffee with his family. And his mother said, you must go back to the World Cup. He said, no, I can't. I want to be here with you, with the family. It's important. And they insisted, and they said, your father, Philip, would want you to go. So he reluctantly went back, and he got back in time for the game against Iran. Now, this is what happened. I saw this on television, and I didn't understand what was happening in the background. So, you know, when the teams come out and they shake hands, generally the last two to shake hands would be whom? You're a Liverpool fan, you're a football fan. So who are the last two that shake hands generally?
I want to say the two captains, but it won't be that, will it? It'll be the it'll be the final player in the lineup.
Well, it can be, or sometimes, or quite often, it ends up being the goalkeeper.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, So I was quite taken aback and surprised when I saw this happen. So they work their way down the line, they shake hands, go through all that, and then the Mexican keeper, and I knew his story, and it was amazing. They were saying amazing that he made it back for the game, and I thought, how sad. And he gets down to the Iranian keeper, shakes, puts his hand out, and the Iranian turns his back on him and walks away. I remember thinking, my God, that's disgraceful. How could he do that? That's appalling. But he walked away 2 yards behind him, bent down and picked up a bouquet of flowers, turned round and pressed them into his hand, and in pidgin English said, for your papa, and he hugged the guy. You know, and then when I read about it after, I thought, blimey, that's beautiful. So really, the moral of the story is never judge a book by its cover. Which have you time for another very quick one?
Of course, yeah, please do.
Derek Redmond, I don't know if you remember this 400-meter wonderful sprinter. He's the guy who was in Barcelona, fancied to win it.
Yeah, and he put amazing, a hammer, yeah.
Hamstring, and he hobbled round, cried, got up, hobbled round, and his dad helped him around. Then his dad let him go just before the finishing line, standing ovation. So I met him recently, and I said, Derek, have you any sportsmanship stories? He said, I've got a good one for you. He said, the sausage story. I said, what? He said, yeah, my dad used to be a sausage referee or judge. I said, really? He said, yeah, they have competitions in sausages. So they mark them according to the shape, the smell, the taste, all the rest of it. He said, and the rule is every sausage starts with a 10. So, and then you bring it down to 9, 8, 7, 6, according to its shape, size, smell, taste, etc. But every sausage starts with a 10 and they work it backwards. And his dad said to him, treat people like sausages. Give everybody a 10 to start with and work your way backwards from there. You know, so don't judge a book by its cover. Sit back. And so actually, when we tell these stories to kids, they get it. You know, they do get it. And it's lovely. So that's a little Derek Redmond gem. And that's on video on the side. You'll see that if you put Derek Redmond into the search engine on greatsportsmanship.org, you'll find that video clip. It's a lovely piece.
That's brilliant. Just going back to the Derek Redmond when he was running around the track and his father runs on to help him. Because I think it was his hamstring that went. And he's in tears and his father runs on. And I remember one of the stewards comes across as if to say to his dad, no, you need to leave him and get off the track. And his dad just says, no, this is not happening. I'm helping my son get to the finish line.
He just dismissed the steward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, I think if you put Derek Redmond into YouTube, you'll probably be able to find that as well. So
absolutely right, yeah.
Amazing. Just back to marketing, unfortunately, because I think we could talk about sportsmanship all day. How do you feel that digital has changed the marketing landscape?
Yeah, digital has changed the marketing landscape forever. It's never going to go back. Digital allows us to help customers in new ways, never dreamt of before. We can add value in so many different ways, like we can lift the cognitive load of customers and just wave it away. You know, Uber taxis. I don't have to stand and figure out on my phone, dial it up, search for a taxi crowd, then dial them, then talk to somebody who may or may not understand me. Then they can't find me. Then they eventually do. I'm cold and wet in the rain at that stage. Get in the car. Then they can't find my house or the party I'm going to. And then we argue about the fare. And all that cognitive load is just whoosh, wiped away by clever use of data. So we can add value in ways that we never dreamt of before. And that for me is a pretty simple example. But we can also personalize offers and become much more relevant to individual needs. And we can reach customers in new ways using digital technologies. And we can deliver. So reach would be about communications. The first added value helping bit is the product. Then reaching customers is kind of promotions and communications. And then delivering products, so the distribution and place side of things, via all sorts of new ways, such as virtual reality. I'm just looking at doing a little bit of work at Greenpeace here. You know, they've got a fantastic virtual reality headset that takes you into the Amazon and you're experiencing all the stuff they're talking about. So they're kind of helping deliver you as well as experience. So they're blurring the traditional marketing mix. Or with AI, you know, which is incredibly exciting, but we need to be a little bit wary and cautious with it as well. Or the Internet of Things, you know, everything connecting to everything. Or marketing automation, you know, automating everything triggered by behaviors and clicks through to big data. You know, all of these are combining to create a brand new sort of level playing field in the world of marketing. And in fact, I think The Economist got it right here when they said that the world's, this is the front page of The Economist last year, 6th of May, in fact, 2017, The Economist magazine front page said the world's most valuable resource is no longer oil, but data. I sat back thinking, my goodness, that's not a marketer. That's an economist saying this. And, you know, the economists and the accountants, sometimes I'm at loggerheads with, because I think the accountants and the financial sector are come way out of sync with what's happening in business, in my opinion, and have been for some time. Because, you know, if your most valuable asset is data, where does that appear on the balance sheet? We've been missing that for a long time. Even your basic database, let alone algorithm and clever usage of them, and so on and so forth. So, which brings us to, you know, the idea of data being so powerful and big data. And I've written about Donald T, you know, how he won his election in America on my blog, prsmith.org. And, you know, there's two posts there explain exactly how he did it. And it's kind of frightening the way he used data. It was an English company that did it for him as well. But the manipulation and the usage of data was so powerful. And even simpler forms of manipulation of data by the NRA, for example, are frightening how they use it and how they have effectively, I believe personally, intimidated senators from voting against NRA because the database they have and the information they spread, it's kind of frightening. Therefore, we really do need to have some sort of protection, as in GDPR. So the General Data Protection Privacy Regulations are really necessary. Although they may be a pain in the neck to implement, it's really much needed. And thankfully, they spread. So American companies, if they're operating in Europe, they're going to have to adhere to those regulations so that they're not immune to it. So that's good. But back to your original question of data changing the marketing landscape, it is. Digital is leading the challenge, and data in particular is now the most valuable asset. And now we're moving into what we call disruptive industries. So, you know, we're bundling value via data. We're finding value through new ways of cleverly moving, like Airbnb, you know, just adding data bits. For Airbnb was going to go out of business, you know, a few years ago. They were on their last legs. And an investor said to the to one of the founders, like, where are your 30 customers that you have? He said, they're upstate New York. He said, well, what are you doing here? So he got on a plane, went over, met them and asked them, how could we be better? Or how's it going, you know, using the Airbnb? And one of the first ones said, well, I feel nervous about having a stranger in my house. I'd like more information. I'd like to know what university they went to. I'd like to know, do they have kids? What's their job? And so he took notes of all this and said, well, that's data that we have. So we, with permission, we can share that with you. And so being clever about what data is useful and what's too much data allowed that company to, well, it was one of the things that helped them to develop and grow into where they are today. I suppose the other big bit of disruption is blockchain. You could say just welcome it with open arms, or you could say it's going to annihilate the banking industry. I don't think it's going to annihilate. I think it's going to facilitate new models, completely different models. But you look at some of the cleverer ones, even pre-blockchain, you know, you've got American banks that will give you a business loan within sort of 3 minutes. Now, whereas it took 3 days, 3 weeks previously. But all they've done is taken the data that's available, assessed the credit, routed that data in front of the teller who's at the counter, and they're able to press a button for existing customers. So they're just using existing data in cleverer ways, which brings us to, again, your question, how does digital change it? It's creating a hyper competition because small guys can get up and get at you very, very quickly. And they're cleverer and they don't have to deal with legacy databases. So the small guy has a great shot at this. Now, what we'll see is more and more disruption, because when I do lectures at various MBA courses, I inevitably end up talking with some of the MBAers. And these are young, excited, enthusiastic, sometimes aggressive people who can't wait to disrupt their particular industry. They're going to get out there and disrupt it and create a new model. And, you know, I call them punk capitalists, because they are going to tear up the rules, and they'll adhere to GDPR and whatever else, but they're going to tear up the rules and it's going to create a new model which will shake and scare everybody who remains old and legacy driven. So you're going to see stuff like hyper competition. We're already seeing it. You know, Amazon and eBay have got apps so that, you know, when you're in the supermarket, they ask you to scan the stuff and they'll give you a better price and deliver it for free anyway. So there's hyper competition in your pocket. So when I say to retailers, you've got to compete with Amazon and eBay, their apps, you've got to have your own app, which is better. And it's not based upon cost or delivery. It has to be some other added value that you've got to find that's relevant to people, that helps their lives. And think about it long enough and you'll get the answers. So anyways, digital is affecting business, whole economies, society, and everybody. In fact, I was in Holland last year where I saw a digital experiment taking place of paying professionals €3,000 a month to do nothing.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I'll be one of those, says you.
Yeah.
So they see that automation as not necessarily a threat, but a factor that's coming in. And the estimates of roughly 30% of blue and white collar, particularly white collar jobs, will go. And some will be replaced by new jobs we never thought of, but others will go. I'm not convinced we will replace all those jobs. So they're looking to say, you're not going to have dual income families everywhere, or you're not going to work a 5-day week all the time. You might have a 3-day week or a 6-hour week and so on, 6-hour day. So things are going to change, and that might bring us back to more community-based stuff where people are actually living in their communities and their neighborhoods, and they're, you know, somebody down the road is a storyteller, somebody up the road that does, you know, Tai Chi, and people just start communicating. So it could be a really good thing. Who knows? But one word of caution I would say with AI, and in particular with super AI. Now, we're on the cusp of the curve, which is, you know, absolutely upwards, like more directly upwards than ever before in terms of innovation and technology development. And so what we're seeing when AI and super AI, when it comes in, you know, we're going to see systems and knowledge-based bots that are cleverer than the cleverest of us all. And you could say we've got that already. We've had it for some time, but it'll become bigger and more apparent to us. So we're just going to be careful when we're using AI to make very, very careful briefs that are thoroughly thought through. You know, for example, if I said to some super AI system, solve the problem of world poverty, you know, one of the most obvious solutions for that AI system to come up with would be, okay, I could do that within 48 hours by wiping out the human species. You know, so we have to really think not just about who has the power, who has the database, who's got the data, who's got the algorithm, but the type of brief people may, you know, unprofessionally make, which could be damaging to the universe that we live in, at least. Yeah. So yeah. I see massive change, but I embrace it. I welcome it. A different structured society, lots of opportunities to add value and to reach customers in new ways we never dreamt of. It's probably the most exciting time ever to be in marketing.
I think with every positive, there always comes negatives, or the potential to have negative. And for me personally, it's all this data and information. As long as it's used ethically, then it's happy days. It's when it's into the wrong hands
Yes. I think it's actually ethically and intelligently, or thought throughly. You know, that's a bit, because it's ethical to say rid the world of poverty. That's a very ethical and noble mission, but it could wipe out the human species simultaneously. So we need ethics combined with transparency and with intelligent briefs or panels or committees that look at big decisions or big briefs that are given to AI super systems. So we need to be cautious, and we need to think through things thoroughly with experts who are given time to ponder the implications of various requests.
Excellent. There's so much in there. Talking about sport, talking about AI, talking about big data, the Internet of Things, a whole host of things there that's just well, it's now, and sometimes you have these conversations and people talk about digital and we need a digital strategy for this and we need to do that, but it's almost like it's just come upon us, and they're like, oh, didn't realize we could do any of this, and it's been around for years. And sometimes I think people get stuck in this, you said, old and legacy driven, and this nostalgic approach that, well, we need to create an advert and it needs to be in print media or it needs to be this. And they almost see that the digital and the more traditional as two very separate things, where in reality, yeah, it needs to be combined to have any chance. Absolutely. Of surviving.
I agree with you 100%. I don't believe we'll even be using the word digital possibly within 3 years. It'll be stripped out of all my marketing books. It'll just be back to marketing again. Integrated stuff should be integrated from day number one.
Do you find it hard when because it's an interesting sort of two worlds colliding when you're writing books about digital, but it's changing so much? Do you find that difficult?
Yeah, it's quite frustrating actually, because I'm doing a book that the manuscript, I won't say which publisher, but the manuscript is due January 2019 and won't be published till October, November. So I'm thinking, really? Why? You know, it's kind of so much has happened in between times, you know, so I think we'll add online stuff to it to keep it up to date. But yeah, no, it is a challenge. And it's just amazing the amount of stuff that's out there that makes it easy and exciting to write about. So there's plenty of new material out there. But the challenge is to keep up with it. Yeah.
Just moving back to more CIM related topics. You used to be a senior examiner for the CIM. So I think something that would be fundamental to listeners to understand is, can you give them any tips that would help them actually help the examiner who's going to end up marking their assignment or exam?
Yeah, for both, I would say, again, back to keeping it simple, is to practice with previous exam papers and read questions very carefully and try to isolate if there's one or two or three sections within a question and highlight them accordingly. And then I would suggest that never start writing an answer just with a blank piece of paper. You know, you have to submit your notes, but write notes, write down your bullet points of what you think the 3, 4, 5, 6 things you can think of, or 10 or more, but get those down so you can look at them, structure them, and then write your answer so that it's easy for a manager or an examiner to digest what you're saying. Don't make them work really hard in a long-winded essay that's only got 1 or 2 points and you think you're clever because you filled up the space. So highlight, put headings, you know, make it out, write as you would a report for a manager. So make their life easy to pluck out the key points. That the examiner should like that. The marker should appreciate that you're trying to be professional and present it in a proper report format.
I think some people, what they struggle with, particularly when they've come from a more academic background, is the fact that I always try and tell students that whatever is on an assignment or an exam or whatever question it might be, you need to write it and answer it as if your manager's come across and said, your work for the day is this, rather than look at it from a more academic point of view where it's a slightly different style of writing.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Just want to move on to some very quick fire questions now, just to lighten the mood a little bit. Now, I'm expecting 1 or 2 sentences in these answers, but if you want to elaborate, then
no, I won't.
Then go ahead. Yep. Certainly not a test.
Okay.
This would probably be a tricky one, or it might be easy for you to answer. But can you name one must read business book?
Apart from my own, of course.
well, that's why I said it might be tricky.
Okay. Actually, I do recommend everybody read Cialdini's Psychology, Cialdini's Influence, Roberto Cialdini's Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. But, you know, I'm interested, obviously, in digital, and I hear American gurus talking about various aspects of digital, and they inevitably refer to Roberto Cialdini's Robert Cialdini's Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. And they refer to it as if it's been just released and just written and it's applied to digital marketing. But in fact, it was written way pre-digital, his early works, you know, in the 80s. And even if you get his 80s stuff rather than his more recent stuff, if you read his book, you'll understand the psychology of persuasion for sure. And you'll also understand how people get better results, whether you're a waiter and get more tips than all the rest of the waiters in the restaurant, little stuff like that, through to how to swing a whole political conversation or a voting campaign, through to selling sweets or shops or stuff in the shops. So Cialdini, I would recommend. There's one other, may I recommend one other?
Of course, yeah.
That I've not actually read.
Okay.
I'm going to go blind in this one because the guy who recommended it and wrote the preface is somebody that I do rate as a writer, and his name is Brian Solis, S-O-L-I-S, the American writer. I do like Brian Solis's stuff. And so he wrote the preface for a book called Digital Sense, The Common Sense Approach to Effectively Blending Social Business Strategy, Marketing Technology, and Customer Experience by two guys called Travis Wright and Chris Snook. So he gave it a great write-up. I read the stuff about it. So I'll get it this week and I'll digest it this week. So that's another one to watch out for.
Two great recommendations. What was the last thing you Googled?
The weather in Dublin. I'm off to Dublin for the Ireland-Scotland game as we pursue a Grand Slam. But we'll take anything. We'll take a Triple Crown. We'll take a championship. We'll take a Grand Slam. So the weather in Google, I'm watching. As I got out of Dublin last week, I was in for the Welsh game. I got out on Tuesday night, and Wednesday all the airports were closed down. So I'm Googling it feverishly.
Excellent. Well, I can report around here there's been absolutely nothing. We had about an inch of snow and then it all disappeared. But this episode might get released and the sun might be shining when people are listening to it. So just for people that are listening to it maybe in July, whenever, this is actually in March and the start of spring, and we got about 8 feet of snow in some parts of the country. What is the app you use most often?
There is one that I show off with. I'm not actually a guitarist, but I have an app called GarageBand, and you turn your phone into a guitar, an acoustic or an electric guitar. It's extraordinary. You can play it. You know, I find it kind of interesting because you can just dabble at it. I'm not a guitarist, but I don't even know how to play a guitar, but I can pick strings out and make the odd note and experiment. So I really like GarageBand. Mematic is a nice little one that makes posters. So you take a photograph of your best mate, and then within 30 seconds, you've got it dropped into a very professional looking template that looks like a poster that was on, you know, the billboard outside the pub. Or Shazam. Shazam has to be the ultimate one for me. You know, to convert noise or music into digital data and then convert that back into identifying the name of the music you're listening to, the words of the song, links to buying the record or the next gig they're doing. It's all about helping the listener and the user. So Shazam has to be number one really for me.
Okay. Other than the obvious, what is your favorite model, theory, or concept?
I'm glad you asked that because I discovered this one. It's called Urbani and Davis, Three Circles. And I discovered this, and I didn't tell you, but I'm currently learning more about marketing now than I ever have when I was studying full-time or part-time, just because the pace of change we're talking about. You know, so it's a minimum of an hour a day, just catching up articles, trying to get on top of the book mountain and all that sort of thing. Minimum an hour a day. And I've been doing that kind of intense digital, you know, pretty much. I've been an avid learner of marketing all my life since, you know, leaving colleges and part-time courses. So when I discovered Urbani and Davis's Three Circles, I sat back and I went, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. It's the best thing I've discovered in 25 years of studying marketing. It's the best thing I've come across. So it's about the search for your distinctive competitive advantage, but it's all done through the eyes of your customers. So check out that. In fact, you get on my blog, prsmith.org, just put Urbani, U-R-B-A-N-I, Urbani in there, and you get it in there. And it's in my Sustack books and all the books I write about, because it's just brilliant. And in just a few minutes, it'll open your eyes to where your real competitive advantage may or may not lie. So it's a wonderful little model, that one.
Great. So I'm going to wrap it up before I go and look. I need to look at that model really quickly and understand it. Yeah. So one very quick final fire question, and then we'll wrap things up. Probably the most important question I'll ask you today. Who is your favorite Smith in the world?
Okay. I would think the famous. Well, it's not Walter Smith. It's not Adam Smith. It's not Smith Must Score. There's a guy in Brighton, a footballer, who missed an open goal opportunity against Man United in the final at Wembley. And the commentator said, Smith must score. And he didn't. He missed it. So even till today, the fanzine magazine is called Smith Must Score, the profile. So he's not my hero. I do have someone, actually. I think it's very selfish to say this, but there's a goalkeeper in QPR called Alexander Smithies, who's fantastic. And there's a new young player we got in by the name of Matthew Smith, who's a terrific player as well. So I'm kind of at a soft spot for both those guys. And there is a Paul Smith who's just joined it, but he's got a Y in there. That's down in Queen's Park Rangers. But actually, I'm very proud of, I have a great grandfather called Tom Smith, and he was a leathersmith in Dublin. And Michael Cusack of the GAA walked into him one day and said, how do you clamp a ball of twine in leather? And you have to visualize this, but his answer was basically immediately, he said, you take the shape of the cup of your hand, the two cups of your hand, and clap them together. And that's the shape of the stitch that you've got on the slitter, which is the ball used in hurling, which is the fastest ball game in the world. And it was adopted by tennis, have used it, baseball have used it, cricket didn't, but he created that stitch. I'm very proud of my great grandfather, Tom Smith, for creating that.
But I didn't think I'd get that answer. That is a really good answer. Paul, it's been
Fantastic talking to you. So one final question before we go. People want to find out more about Sustack, which they clearly should and will. And then I could say find out more about all your books and this intro to the question will last forever. But if they want to find more out about Sustack or get in touch with yourself, where should they go?
PRsmith.org or Sustack.org. You'll get me. Get me on Facebook, LinkedIn, PR Smith Marketing, any of those. You can, and Sustack on Facebook or LinkedIn or on the website. So easy to track down. PR Smith Marketing is probably the easiest.
Fantastic. Paul Smith, or PR Smith, as you're more commonly known, thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a real joy, a real pleasure talking to you, and I wish you and all your listeners all the very best.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Marketing Study Lab. It really means the world that you're listening to this out there. And hopefully I've provided you some value. If you're looking to know more about what Marketing Study Lab does and is about, go to marketingstudylab.co.uk or get in touch with me personally, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or feel free to email me at peter@marketingstudylab.co.uk. Happy marketing.